Chapter 1. At a court festival, Nabonidus, the Red Priest, who was the real ruler of the city, touched Murillo, the young aristocrat, courteously on the arm. Murillo turned to meet the priest's enigmatic gaze and to wonder at the hidden meaning therein. No words passed between them, but Nabonidus bowed and handed Murillo a small gold cask. The young nobleman, knowing that Nabonidus did nothing without reason, excused himself at the first opportunity and returned hastily to his chamber. There he opened the cask and found within a human ear, which he recognized by a peculiar scar upon it. He broke into a profuse sweat and was no longer in doubt about the meaning in the Red Priest's glance. But Murillo, for all his scented black curls and foppish apparel, was no weakling to bend his neck to the knife without a struggle. He did not know whether Nabonidus was merely playing with him or giving him a chance to go into voluntary exile, but the fact that he was still alive and at liberty proved that he was to be given at least a few hours, probably for meditation. However, he needed no meditation for decision. What he needed was a tool, and fate furnished that tool. Working among the dives and brothels of the squalid quarters, even while the young nobleman shivered and pondered in the part of the city occupied by the purple-towered marble and ivory palaces of the aristocracy, there was a priest of Anu whose temple, rising at the fringe of the slum district, was the scene of more than devotions. The priest was fat and full-fed, and he was at once a fence for stolen articles and a spy for the police. He worked a thriving trade both ways because the district on which he bordered was the maze, a tangle of muddy, winding alleys and sordid dens frequented by the border thieves in the kingdom. Daring above all were a Gunderman deserter from the mercenaries and a barbaric Cimmerian. Because of the priest of Anu, the Gunderman was taken and hanged in the market square. But the Cimmerian fled, and learning in devious ways the priest's treachery, he entered the temple of Anu by night and cut off the priest's head. There followed a great turmoil in the city, but the search for the killer proved fruitless until a woman betrayed him to the authorities and led a captain of the guard and his squad to the hidden chamber where the barbarian lay drunk. Waking to stupefied but ferocious life when they seized him, he disemboweled the captain, burst through his assailants, and would have escaped but for the liquor that still clouded his senses. Bewildered and half-blinded, he missed the open door in his headlong flight and dashed his head against the stone wall so terrifically that he knocked himself senseless. When he came to, he was in the strongest dungeon in the city, shackled to the wall with chains not even his barbaric thews could break. To this cell came Murillo, masked and wrapped in a wide black cloak. The Cimmerian surveyed him with interest, thinking him the executioner sent to dispatch him. Murillo set him at rights and regarded him with no less interest. Even in the dim light of the dungeon, with his limbs loaded with chains, the primitive power of the man was evident. His mighty body and thick-muscled limbs combined the strength of a grizzly with the quickness of a panther. Under his tangled black mane, his blue eyes blazed with unquenchable savagery.
"Would you like to live?"
asked Murillo. The barbarian grunted, new interest glinting in his eyes.
"If I arrange for your escape, will you do a favor for me?"
the aristocrat asked. The Cimmerian did not speak, but the intentness of his gaze answered for him.
"I want you to kill a man for me."
"Who?"
Murillo's voice sank to a whisper.
"Nabonidus, the king's priest."
The Cimmerian showed no sign of surprise or perturbation. He had none of the fear or reverence for authority that civilization instills in men. King or beggar, it was all one to him. Nor did he ask why Murillo had come to him when the quarters were full of cutthroats outside prisons.
"When am I to escape?" he demanded.
"Within the hour. There is but one guard in this part of the dungeon at night. He can be bribed. He has been bribed. See, here are the keys to your chains. I'll remove them, and after I have been gone an hour, the guard, Athicus, will unlock the door to your cell. You will bind him with strips torn from your tunic, so that when he is found, the authorities will think that you are rescued from outside and will not suspect him. Go at once to the house of the Red Priest and kill him. Then go to the rat's den, where a man will meet you and give you a pouch of gold and a horse. With those, you can escape from the city and flee the country."
"Take off these cursed chains now," demanded the Cimmerian.
and have the guard bring me food. By Crom, I have lived on moldy bread and water for a whole day, and I am nigh to famishing.
It shall be done, but remember, you are not to escape until I have had time to reach my home.
Freed of his chains, the barbarian stood up and stretched his heavy arms, enormous in the gloom of the dungeon. Murillo again felt that if any man in the world could accomplish the task he had set, this Cimmerian could. With a few repeated instructions, he left the prison, first directing Athicus to take a platter of beef and ale into the prisoner. He knew he could trust the guard, not only because of the money he had paid, but also because of certain information he possessed regarding the man. When he returned to his chamber, Murillo was in full control of his fears. Nabonidus would strike through the king, of that he was certain. And since the royal guardsmen were not knocking at his door, it was certain that the priest had said nothing to the king so far. Tomorrow he would speak, beyond a doubt, if he lived to see tomorrow. Murillo believed the Cimmerian would keep faith with him. Whether the man would be able to carry out his purpose remained to be seen. Men had attempted to assassinate the Red Priest before, and they had died in hideous and nameless ways. But they had been products of the cities of men, lacking the wolfish instincts of the barbarian. The instant that Murillo, turning the gold cask with its severed ear in his hands, had learned through his secret channels that the Cimmerian had been captured, he had seen a solution of his problem. In his chamber again he drank a toast to the man, whose name was Conan, and to his success that night. And, while he was drinking, one of his spies brought him the news that Athicus had been arrested and thrown into prison. The Cimmerian had not escaped. Murillo felt his blood turn to ice again. He could see in this twist of fate only the sinister hand of Nabonidus, and an eerie obsession began to grow on him that the Red Priest was more than human, a sorcerer who read the minds of his victims and pulled strings on which they danced like puppets. With despair came desperation. Girding a sword beneath his black cloak, he left his house by a hidden way and hurried through the deserted streets. It was just at midnight when he came to the house of Nabonidus, looming blackly among the walled gardens that separated it from the surrounding estates. The wall was high, but not impossible to negotiate. Nabonidus did not put his trust in mere barriers of stone. It was what was inside the wall that was to be feared. What these things were, Murillo did not know precisely. He knew that there was at least a huge savage dog that roamed the gardens and had on occasion torn an intruder to pieces as a hound rends a rabbit. What else there might be, he did not care to conjecture. Men who had been allowed to enter that house on brief legitimate business reported that Nabonidus dwelt among rich furnishings, yet simply, attended by a surprisingly small number of servants. Indeed, they mentioned only one as having been visible, a tall, silent man called Joka. Someone else, presumably a slave, had been heard moving about in the recesses of the house, but this person no one had ever seen. The greatest mystery of the mysterious house was Nabonidus himself, whose power of intrigue and grasp on international politics had made him the strongest man in the kingdom. People, chancellor, and king moved puppet-like on the strings he worked. Murillo scaled the wall and dropped down into the gardens, which were expanses of shadow, darkened by clumps of shrubbery and waving foliage. No light shone in the windows of the house, which loomed so blackly among the trees. The young nobleman stole stealthily yet swiftly through the shrubs. Momentarily he expected to hear the baying of the great dog and to see its giant body hurtle through the shadows. He doubted the effectiveness of his sword against such an attack, but he did not hesitate. As well die beneath the fangs of a beast as of the headsman. He stumbled over something, bulky and yielding. Bending close in the dim starlight, he made out a limp shape on the ground. It was the dog that guarded the gardens, and it was dead. Its neck was broken, and it bore what seemed to be the marks of great fangs. Murillo felt that no human being had done this. The beast had met a monster more savage than itself. Murillo glanced nervously at the cryptic mass of bush and shrub, then with a shrug of his shoulders he approached the silent house. The first door he tried proved to be unlocked. He entered warily, sword in hand, and found himself in a long, shadowy hallway, dimly illuminated by a light that gleamed through the hangings at the other end. Complete silence hung over the whole house. Murillo glided along the hall and halted to peer through the hangings. He looked into a lighted room, over the windows of which velvet curtains were drawn so closely as to allow no beam to shine through. The room was empty insofar as human life was concerned, but it had a grisly occupant nevertheless. In the midst of a wreckage of furniture and torn hangings that told of a fearful struggle lay the body of a man. The form lay on its belly, but the head was twisted about so that the chin rested behind a shoulder. The features, contorted to an awful grin, seemed to leer at the horrified nobleman. For the first time that night, Murillo's resolution wavered. He cast an uncertain glance back the way he had come. Then the memory of the headsman's block and axe steeled him, and he crossed the room, swerving to avoid the grinning horror sprawled in its midst. Though he had never seen the man before, he knew from former descriptions that it was Joka, Nabonidus's saturnine servant. He peered through a curtained door into a broad circular chamber, banded by a gallery halfway between the polished floor and the lofty ceiling. This chamber was furnished as if for a king. In the midst of it stood an ornate mahogany table, loaded with vessels of wine and rich viands. And Murillo stiffened. In a great chair, whose broad back was toward him, he saw a figure whose habiliments were familiar. He glimpsed an arm and a red sleeve resting on the arm of the chair. The head, clad in the familiar scarlet hood of the gown, was bent forward as if in meditation. Just so Murillo had seen Nabonidus sit 100 times in the royal court. Cursing the pounding of his own heart, the young nobleman stole across the chamber, sword extended, his whole frame poised for the thrust. His prey did not move, nor seem to hear his cautious advance. Was the red priest asleep, or was it a corpse which slumped in that great chair? The length of a single stride separated Murillo from his enemy. Then suddenly the man in the chair rose and faced him. The blood went suddenly from Murillo's features. His sword fell from his fingers and rang on the polished floor. A terrible cry broke from his livid lips. It was followed by the thud of a falling body. Then, once more, silence reigned over the house of the Red Priest.